Hello and welcome to Stepping Into Truth, the podcast where we have conversations on race, gender, and social justice. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I'm very happy that you're here for this conversation. Welcome to season three. I can't believe that this is my third year doing this podcast, and I'm so excited about the conversations that are coming in this season. Before we begin, I want to say that I love how intellectually stimulating these conversations are. And they're not meant to only be intellectually stimulating. They're meant to move us into meaningful action. So as you listen, I encourage you to think about how you might be able to make a difference. And at the end of the discussion, my guests are going to give you some ideas about simple things that you can do to move us closer to our social justice goals. So keep those in mind too. My guest today is Nicole Vick. Nicole Vick is a public health professional, educator, civic leader, and image consultant who has spent the last 15 years providing tools and strategies to stakeholders, community-based organizations, students, and residents to improve health and prevent disease in some of Los Angeles County's most underserved communities. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Nicole Vick to the podcast. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, it's so great to be here talking to you. I'm so excited to have this conversation today. It's so needed.
Oh, boy, you nailed that right on the head. And because you started there, I'm going to just jump in and say that I heard this statistic this week that really stopped me in my tracks. And it's that Birmingham, Alabama is in the midst of a real crisis with COVID-19. And I knew that. I mean, I'd heard that they were a hot spot. But what I didn't know was, besides that they're on the verge of having no room in their ICUs, that Birmingham is a population that's 72% Black. But 90% of those in their hospitals with COVID-19 are Black. So that's an 18 percentage point disparity. And it doesn't feel like that's an accident. It feels like it's the result of health problems that are connected to systemic racism, and that those problems make us more susceptible to this disease and other diseases. And I would love for you to talk about how these inequities are showing up in the midst of this crisis.
You know, you're absolutely right. They aren't accidents. These are not accidents. These are systemic issues. I've spent the last 15 years working in public health. I've been teaching for about 12 years. And coincidentally, we talk about Alabama in my class. There is a situation in one of the counties there where they still have hookworm because there's no sewage systems up there or down there. And, you know, it just speaks to some of the larger systemic issues that are occurring, and specifically among African Americans or Black people, and that is kind of setting them up for some of the terrible issues in terms of COVID. So these are not accidents. And unfortunately, I was not surprised because we see the same issues with HIV, STD. We see the same issues with diabetes and other types of diseases. So this is just another example of how institutional and systemic racism can really impact the health of Black people.
Part of what I saw that I found so shocking was that apparently there's the city council in Birmingham took a vote the other day on whether to make wearing of face coverings in public mandatory. And the council split 4-4, and it was completely along racial lines. So the motion did not pass. So the most basic thing that the council could have done to protect the health of its citizens didn't happen. And all I could think was, if 90% of the people in those hospital beds with COVID-19 were white, I am absolutely certain that that motion would have passed and that they would have required that people in public wear face coverings to protect themselves and each other. And it was such a disturbing statement on where we are, even with all the protests that are going on that are highlighting the inequities in the system, that city council still felt completely fine with not regulating the simplest thing to avoid this issue. And I think that extends far beyond just face coverings and COVID-19, that actually is a challenge for people in public health across the board. Am I right about that?
Absolutely, you are correct. One of the other things that has been very disturbing to me is I think I'm learning that a lot of people don't understand public health, for one, and they have a distrust for science that is a little bit alarming. So when public health officials speak, I see a lot of distrust or misunderstanding. I don't know if you heard, but in Orange County, the public health official in Orange County pretty much had to resign. They sort of pressured her, and she feared for her safety, her family's safety, and ended up leaving her job. She was trying to enforce some of the very things that you're talking about. Hey, can we wear face coverings in public? That is an important measure to protect the public, and the residents and everyone else was like, we don't want that. And she actually was forced to walk away from her job. And it just speaks to, I think, there's that racist undertone, but then there's also this misunderstanding or lack of concern or care for basic public health principles that is very concerning.
I would like to back up and just have you tell us what public health actually means.
So in simple terms, public health is about prevention of disease, and promotion of health in communities. So when we think about public health and try to compare it or contrast it to medical care, what we're saying is we want to keep communities of people healthy so that they don't have to go to the doctor to be hospitalized or have medication or treatment. And the premise is that public health is cheaper and less expensive than healthcare. So if we can keep people healthy and out of hospitals, then that means we can, you know, reduce some of the burden from the healthcare system. And so that's really all public health is about. How can we keep you and your community? And a community can be a group of people that have similar interests. It can be geographic. How can we keep these folks healthy? Create a system or a society where people have access to the resources to keep them healthy.
I think it's really interesting that you say that, because I think often people don't think of public health in that way. But my godson, when he was in high school, this subject came up for some reason, I don't recall what. And he said that he thinks that one of the things that determines how people perceive the idea of public health is by how they perceive the idea of community, and that the larger they experience their community to be, the more aligned they are with the notion of public health. That, you know, when they think that their community is not just their family or the people in their neighborhood, but the people in their town, the people in their county, the people in their state, and broader, just people, that they're more invested in the notion of public health, and that the smaller you think your community is, the less invested in that you are, the more likely you are to feel like it's just, I'm going to just take care of myself and my family. And I found that really interesting perspective from a teenager.
I think he's absolutely right. And I notice that in some of the Facebook posts or the social media posts that I see around these issues, you see people like, I want to go get my haircut. I want to be able to do what I want to do. And it's like, how narrow, to your point, how narrow do you see your community to think that these types of things are okay when we're dealing with a global pandemic that we've never seen before? So I think you're right. And the other part of it that's interesting to me and that I've had conversations with people about is our society, American society, is basically founded on the concept of individuality, right? You do what you want to do. This is my house. I want to do this thing. And so how can we now ask people to think collectively in the way that public health wants us to think about when we're not, that's not how we're taught to think. And so when we see posts like, well, I want to go get my hair cut.
Right.
Wait, there's people that are dying. You want your hairstylist to die? They don't have that frame of mind. We have not ingrained that into our society in that way. So, you know, it's kind of sad. Yeah.
I think it's actually sort of, and it's now kind of devolving into a rift between different sides of the political spectrum, which it really should not be. It should not be that, you know, Democrats believe in public health and Republicans believe in personal responsibility to the exclusion of public health. I mean, it should not be that way, but it does feel like that's the direction we're moving in. And I think that's very concerning because all indications are we are far, far from dealing with the end of this. We are still in the beginning of this. And if we don't figure out how as a country to engage with this challenge, I don't see things even remotely going back to something that approaches normal anytime soon.
I agree. I think our normal, we have a new normal now. We will not be going back. And you're right. We have to figure out how we can cross that line, Democrat, Republican. Wait a minute. There should be some basic things that both sides agree on. And public health and science should absolutely be one of those things that, you know, regardless of some of the individual beliefs or principles, public health should absolutely be something that is understood and embraced as important across the board.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm just going to say, do I want a haircut? Oh, yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Am I going to go to the salon and get my haircut? Nope. That's not happening. It's not worth it. It's not worth the risk to me. It's not worth the risk to other people. So something that you said in your book that I found really profound was, it's our job to take a system that's functioning exactly as it was designed to and turn it on its head. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly right. This system that we have, our system of public health, our system of how we engage with communities of color is working exactly as it was designed to. It's working to take funds and resources away from other, from our communities and put them elsewhere. And I'm curious, when you think about turning the system on its head, I would love to hear what your vision for that is.
So I've thought about this quite a bit, and I honestly, I think we have to tear the whole system down. And I don't know what that looks like. But it's really hard to try to fix something that is literally hanging by a thread. I had a conversation with a colleague once. We were talking about African-American infant and maternal mortality and how the rates are so very high. And I said, you know, it's crazy. This country was built on very racist principles. You know, the whole thing is just wrong. She said, well, how do we fix it? I said, we got to tear this whole thing down. It's the equivalent of a house on a messed up foundation. And we're saying, let's paint it and put some pretty curtains up. Like, we're beyond, we have to start over. And I really don't know what starting over means. But I think that what is happening right now in our society, we're hopefully starting to see the beginnings of the dismantling of that entire system. We have to start over. And I can't even tell you what that would look like, but it has to happen because it can't, we can't continue to try to piecemeal and fix this here, fix this there. We've been doing that for how many years and we have not gotten very far.
Yeah. I wonder if tearing it down and starting over looks like letting people have a conversation, the conversation that they're actually starting to have now across racial lines, across lines of privilege and lack of privilege, across lines of wealth and poverty. And because the piecemeal thing clearly isn't working. I mean, this is for sure. People have been sort of chipping around the edges. Yep. But I think that the point that it is a crumbling foundation is very valid, and it's going to have to influence how we look at the whole thing. So, I mean, we don't want the house collapsing in on us. And that, I mean, right. We are kind of on the precipice of that right now.
Yes. Yes.
You know, so how do we pull ourselves back from the brink and say, okay, this structure is unsafe. We're going to stand outside and figure this out. We're not going to stay in the house and wait for it to fall down on our heads.
Right. Absolutely.
So, yeah. You mentioned something, though, that I'm very interested in. And you mentioned Black maternal and infant mortality rates. And it astonishes me. But the truth is that Black women with a college education are more likely to die in childbirth or have their babies die than a white woman with a high school education. So mortality rates are not correlated by education and access and economics. So I'd like for you to talk about that and what you found, what you think the core of the problem is, and what you think solutions might be, if you have any.
Sure. So, you know, this whole Black infant and maternal mortality issue is very concerning to me. I'm a Black woman and I'm a mother, and I had my daughter, she's 23 years old. I had her at an age 18, I think it was 18 years old. She was 3 pounds, 11 ounces when she was born. So we could very well be talking about my own infant mortality story. You know, she was 8 weeks early. She could have not been here today. So those issues are very close to my heart. And I think one of the important things to think about is, in public health, we talk a lot about education being this social determinant of health, that the more years of education you have, the longer you live, the better your health outcomes are. They're in some sense a protective factor. But when we think about Black infant and maternal mortality, we realize education does not help. It doesn't protect Black women from having these horrible health outcomes in regards to maternal and infant mortality. One of the strategies that has proven to be very effective in reducing Black infant and maternal mortality is the use of doulas. So doulas are qualified, very educated and experienced women that help pregnant women along their journey through pregnancy up through delivery. And they have been used and have been shown overall to have really good results in improving the rates that we're seeing. The other thing that actually also works really well is nurse family partnership programs, where a similar to a doula, but also where there's a nurse that comes in and works with that mom through her process from pregnancy through delivery. So I think we need to figure out a way to fund some of these programs so that more Black women have access to them. The support that they provide is invaluable. Black women experience so much stress due to structural racism in their lives that we're seeing that is what is causing preterm deliveries and some of the issues with maternal mortality. So I think doulas probably would be a huge benefit to many of the women that are pregnant.
So what is it about doulas that makes the difference, do you think?
Well, I think specifically when you have a Black doula and you are a Black woman, that woman is able to understand where you're coming from. There's no need to explain. You know, I don't have to give you this explanation about what's happening. That doula can understand because oftentimes the perspective is the same. The other thing that is really important about doulas is that they act as advocates. So there are documented, you know, studies, information that talk about the implicit bias that often medical providers exhibit with Black patients, especially Black women. And so that doula can act as an advocate for the woman as she's going to her visits, can advocate for, you know, hey, she says she's in pain, or, you know, sometimes there's this disbelief, or the doctor misinterprets or doesn't really understand the patient's expression of pain or whatever their needs are. So that doula can really help be an advocate and help to kind of keep everything going and running smoothly. So I think that's what makes the difference for sure.
That's really interesting. So what I'm hearing when you say that is that a big part of the problem is that medical professionals don't really listen to their Black female patients. So the doula plays the role of interceding between those two people. And I appreciate that she is doing that. And at the same time, I'm really irritated because if a woman is telling you that she's in pain, she shouldn't need to get someone else to explain that for you if you're the doctor.
Right.
So it's interesting to see how our structural understanding of Black women shows up, because this feels to me very much like Black women are both tough,
yes,
and angry kind of thing. So we're both, you know, we're both able to withstand a lot of physical discomfort and we're angry. So if we're saying we're in pain, we're just basically complaining.
Right.
And that bias. Yeah.
It's huge. It's huge. And you know, to your point, I think there also needs to be a lot more work done in medical schools, nursing schools, to help doctors understand, you know, I don't know, do they do implicit bias training in medical schools? Maybe they do. I don't know. A lot more work needs to be done on that. Because, you know, if Serena Williams can complain and not be heard and almost die, right?
Right. I will tell you a little story. When I was a young actor, one of the jobs I had to make money before I started making any money was pretending to be a patient in a hospital in New York City for medical students. And the whole thing was set up so that they would come in and they would examine everybody and they would have an opportunity to be evaluated on how they were engaging with the patients. And there were different roles that people had. And there were only three or four of them. And a friend of mine, a white friend of mine, and I played the same role. A professional woman in her 20s who was coming in because she was having some sort of I forget what the specific problem was, but it wasn't gynecological. It was just some sort of basic problem. And one day I was dealing with this particular group of students. And out of the students, three of them, when doing the medical intake on me, they said to me, "So how many abortions have you had?"
Wow.
And my character had never been pregnant. And I asked my friend later, I said, "Do they ask you that?" And she said, "No, they ask me if I've ever been pregnant."
Wow.
And yeah, and I found that so telling. And I remember telling the person who was in charge of the program about this, and she kind of blew it off. And I thought, this is not something to blow off. If they're not asking Claire how many abortions she's had, and they're asking me, then there's a problem that has to do with them seeing Claire as a person and them seeing me as a Black person.
Yeah.
And that's what they're seeing, and their biases and their assumptions kicking in. And that was fascinating to me and infuriating because I really wasn't heard.
Right.
But it gave me so much information, and it actually wound up empowering me when I went to doctors in the future. It's like, okay, I understand how this is going to work, and you need to make sure that you're listening to me because otherwise I'm getting up and I'm walking.
Right. Absolutely. And just imagine a woman that may not have had that level of awareness that you have and doesn't know how to advocate. You know, a lot of us are taught to respect physicians, to respect and not to question. So if you hadn't, you know, a woman that doesn't have that level of experience that has no idea that they can push back. And so
Absolutely.
They kind of stuck. If you're on Medi-Cal, Medicaid, you know, you don't know that you can, some people don't know they can switch doctors. And so there's a lot of that needs to be dealt with on both sides. But I put the majority of the work and effort needs to go in these medical schools. These doctors need a lot more education and training on implicit bias.
Yes, I could not agree more. And this is where I really appreciate the doulas being there to advocate for their patients, because just having someone advocate for you teaches you also that you are worthy of being advocated for and that you can potentially as well advocate for yourself. So I think it's really important.
Yes.
So something else that I wanted to ask you about, because this is right in your wheelhouse, I think, is the subject of societal impediments to positive health outcomes. So you live in LA, I used to live in LA, you live in South Central, I used to live in Santa Monica, and they are not that far apart, and they are two different worlds.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Totally different worlds.
Absolutely.
I mean, I lived down the street from the food co-op where there was abundant fresh produce. And when you walked down the street in Santa Monica, you would find juice bar after juice bar after
right.
juice bar. It's like, don't y'all have something else to do here? But you go to South Central, good luck. I mean, you're not going to find a juice bar on every corner. You're not going to find fresh produce on every corner. And these are impediments. If you have to drive any kind of distance to get fresh food, but you can just go to the corner and get fast food, what are you going to do?
Right.
And I just find it so interesting. And I would love for you to talk about your experience of trying to bring awareness of those impediments into the system.
Sure. So one of the things that happened to me very early in my public health career was some of the things that you talked about, you know, driving around my community in the area that I served in. When I first started working, I had the pleasure of working in the very neighborhoods that I grew up in. So I knew where I was at. I understood the landscape, the people. And then you start heading west and it's like, wait, how come we have a million liquor stores, you know, in a certain area? But then as soon as you cross over, let's say La Cienega, maybe starting heading west, everything looks different. You know, the landscape is totally different. The people look different. And there's so much more resources. To your point, you know, I can talk forever. I can do health education classes forever and tell people to eat better, drink more water, don't eat fast food. But if you walk outside of the door after that class, and as you say, all that's down that street is fast food, why am I asking people in communities to do more than what the community, what the system and the society is doing for them? Why am I asking you to take three buses to go to Trader Joe's or to Sprouts to get good food when there are, you know, other people don't have to do those things? And so I think it's just very unfair to have this high expectation for communities to do certain things. Well, you're supposed to exercise, you're supposed to do these things, when the communities don't have the amenities available. There, yes, we have parks in South Central LA, but if the perception is that those parks are not safe, I'm not going out there, I'm not doing it. And it doesn't matter that exercise is good for me. I'm not jeopardizing my safety or my children's safety to go do something that I think is not going to be beneficial to me. Because if I'm dead, exercise is not going to help me, right?
No, it's not. No, it is not. And I think that that's a really important point, is that if the structure isn't there, then it takes an enormous amount of personal effort to do the best thing for your health, to do the best thing for your well-being. If the structure is there, I mean, in Santa Monica, you don't have to work at it to drink green juice. You just have to, you know, fall into the next store down the block and there you are. It makes it easy. The parks are safe. You can get to the beach in 5 minutes and be, you know, but even if you can't get to the beach, you can walk around a little park in the neighborhood and you're not going to feel at risk. If you don't have the infrastructure that supports health and well-being and exercise and all the things that we are told we should be doing, then you're right, you're not going to do it.
Absolutely.
And you should not be blamed for it, because if those things were not available to the people who live in Santa Monica or Brentwood or Hollywood, they would not be doing those things at those rates either. Their rate of participating in healthy lifestyles would also decline, because let's face it, most of us are kind of lazy and we will do the thing that's easiest if we possibly can get away with it.
Absolutely. And that's why I always make the argument, especially when I'm teaching public health, we can't focus primarily on individual responsibility, especially if you have not created a society where it makes it easy for people to do the right thing. The easy choice needs to be the healthy choice. If the healthy choice is hard, I'm not even going to do it. So if I, and I'm educated, if I'm not going to do it, why would I expect someone else to do it? So in public health, we talk about, we need to make the default choice the easier choice, and then people will probably be more likely to accept that choice and then keep up with it over time.
Exactly. I mean, it's just human nature. And I think that public health at its best brings human nature and resources and an understanding of human psychology to bear to make it that it's simpler to do the right thing than to do something that's going to be damaging to you.
Right.
Yeah, it's just such an important thing. And as we're in the midst of this pandemic, I'm seeing it more and more. You know, I was out walking this morning before I got on this interview with you, and I was looking at all the people who weren't wearing face coverings, and I was thinking, don't smile at me if you're not wearing a face covering, because I'm not smiling back.
You know, I'm getting pretty belligerent about it behind my face mask here. I'm like, come on, people, you know, do the right thing. Please, please. None of us think this is fun. Do the right thing.
We all have to work together, right?
We totally do. So I would just like to ask you, because our time is about up, I would like to ask you, if you can give us three things, three simple things that people can do to advance the overall goals of public health and looking at things in community. So what suggestions would you have for us, considering that, yes, we are in a pandemic and no, we don't have enough funding for a lot of these programs, but in an ideal world, what would you like people to do?
I think the first thing that is so important is to be a public health ambassador. Learn, get as much information as you can, look to the experts, do your research. There's so much information that is out there about what we can do to protect ourselves regarding, you know, the masks, washing your hands, staying at home. And I think the other important thing along with that is to correct with love, right? We don't want people to get belligerent and angry. And I think that that doesn't help when people are coming at people in a certain way, they get stuck in their stance even stronger. But if there's a way to correct folks and to provide information to people that you care about so that they understand, I think that's a lot. That's a huge help to us. That's the first thing. The second thing is to really get engaged with local government. What is the mayor talking about in regards to public health? What is your county board of supervisors, or what is your public health officials? What are they talking about? How can you vote differently or push for things that need to happen in your community? I think that's also really important. And then I think finally, you know, just stay involved. I think we have gotten into a situation now where we are very much into our social media and we don't really interact with other people. But if there's ways to kind of collect and get folks together, of course, with social distancing and your mask, of course, be safe. But how can you start to engage with people in your neighborhood? How many of us know our neighbors? To be honest, I don't. I see them and I wave. I don't know their names. How can we get those folks engaged and start to have conversations about how to better community? I think those are really the most important and actually relatively simple things that people can do to improve the public health in their community.
Thank you. And one of the things that I've been really focused on since this epidemic started was the notion of everything being community-centric, and just that community is going to play a larger part in our lives because we are restricted somewhat still in our movement. I mean, I don't know about anybody else out there, but it's going to be a while before I get on a plane. I'm just saying.
Right.
That's not my idea of a good time right now. So community is becoming even more important. And so I really appreciate that you mentioned that. I think it's really, really going to be a big part of how we navigate our way through this as well.
Yep.
Nicole, this was great. This was so good. I'm so glad to have had the opportunity to speak with you and hear your wisdom and just your perspective on this incredibly important issue. So thank you so much for participating in this. Thank you.
Thank you. I had a great time. I love speaking with you. And if you ever want me to come back, I'm here.
That's excellent, and I will remember that. So thanks again, and I want to thank all of you for listening. I hope that you found this conversation as helpful and informative and inspiring as I did. While we're definitely living in a challenging time, we also have the opportunity to make significant change right now. Figure out what you can do, and then do it. Even a small action helps. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do that in my Patreon community for as little as $3 a month. And you can find a link to that at omkariwilliams.com. As always, remember that change starts when we share our stories. So keep sharing yours. I'll be back with another episode very soon.